Thank you all. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm so pleased to be here with you. I am from the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker organization in Washington, D.C., if you're not familiar with us. It's so nice to be here with capital F Friends and lowercase f Friends and everyone who is interested in wrestling with the moral questions of drone warfare together. As that introduction pointed out, I work on several issues of national security, militarism, and civil liberties, and finding those intersections from a faith perspective. One thing that is central to everything I work on is what we call the AUMF. So I want to talk to you about the story of the 2001 Authorization for the Use of Military Force, the AUMF. I'm going to hone in on that really specifically. So I've got a few questions that we're going to answer here together. The first one is, what is the AUMF? Where did it come from? So immediately after the attacks of September 11th, I think we all remember there was this feeling in the air, this tension, this sort of human desire to retaliate, to answer militarily. And I should stop here, and I'm really glad. I gave this talk at a high school, and I said, I think we all remember what that was like. And they were all like, we don't remember. We were like two. So I'm pleased that I'm with people who also remember today. But there was that sense in the air that we wanted to retaliate. And of course, militarism is the way we respond to threats, and that is what is baked into us, and that is our reaction. So here was a really difficult task. I think, as we all know, it is the constitutional mandate, not of the executive branch, but of the legislative branch, to choose when and where to go to war. This is because, as the founders foresaw in their documents, and we can read a lot of fascinating discussion from James Madison and others, that the executive branch is the one that is most prone to go to war. And that is why that check was put into the Constitution, to ensure that there wasn't the singular decision when and where to go to war, when to use lethal force, in the hands of one singular executive. That is why that decision was placed in the legislative branch. So it was the responsibility of Congress to declare war. Now, as we may know, we haven't declared war in quite a while, not officially. What we've gotten into doing is Congress authorizes force. So here was a unique challenge. How do you authorize force in this situation? In those really confusing days after September 11th, there were these questions of, who are we targeting? Where are they? What does it mean to defeat them? So there was a lot of wrangling there among attorneys, among members of Congress, among the executive and others, saying, how exactly do we craft this specific authorization for force in the wake of what just happened? So what they came up with was 60 words. A single sentence. It's been called the most dangerous sentence in American history. I'll read it for you. That the president is authorized to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11th, 2001, or harbored such organizations or persons in order to prevent any future acts of international terrorism against the United States by such nations, organizations, or persons. Does that sound specific to you? So that was passed 3 days after September 11th by Congress. It was hasty, it was quick, there was an urgency. Does anybody know what the vote count was on that vote? That's right. One person voted against it. It was nearly unanimous. And that was Congresswoman Barbara Lee of California. We love Barbara Lee. So I encourage for the high tech among us, get on YouTube and check out her floor speech of the day that she decided to vote against it. Because it was a really moving floor speech. And one of the things that really struck me was she begged her fellow members of Congress, as we move forward, as we act, let us not become the evil we deplore. And I think that was really prescient, because that was September of 2001, and here we are together, 2015. That AUMF is still with us. So let's dive a little more deep. What exactly is the AUMF? We've just read the text. It has no geographic boundaries, no sunset clause, no defined targets, no identification of when this war would be over or when the mission would be accomplished. In addition to that enormous textual sort of blank check, there's been this phrase that has been interpreted into it. I'm sure you've heard it many times, associated forces. Whenever the administration talks about who it is that we're targeting, who it is we're fighting, there's this sort of laundry list of, well, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, this group, that group, and of course, associated forces. What does that mean? We don't really know. There's never been a clear answer. Members of Congress have actually held hearings to try to get to the bottom of exactly what the administration means when they talk about targeting associated forces. We've gotten certain answers such as, there is no official list per se of which organizations or individuals are considered to be associated forces. An individual who wasn't even born on September 11th could later in life be targeted by the AOMF because they associated himself with a group who at some points associates itself with Al-Qaeda. Senator Angus King of Maine, I think, had my favorite reaction to the idea of associated forces. He said to an administration official, "You keep using this term associated forces. That's not in the AOMF. And you said at one point, oh, it suits us very well. I assume it does suit you very well because you're reading it to cover everything and anything. And you guys have invented this term associated forces that is nowhere in this document. It is the justification for everything, and it renders the war powers of the Congress null and void." Is a really harsh line of questioning there. So I think that's correct. The AMF has essentially turned the globe into a battlefield. It's very easy for the executive to bypass the legislature and decide to go to war, to use lethal force, to use military force against individuals and organizations. And this is a really novel concept. It wasn't an authorization of force against an established army or a clear-cut fighting force, something that Gabor went into a little more in depth with us. Or individuals can be targeted for their affiliations and their associations. So unfortunately, I should also add that this idea of associated forces has been validated by the court system, largely in the law of detention and what's been happening in Guantanamo and elsewhere. Basically, the AOMF is the legal justification for that indefinite detention that's taking place. The courts have essentially decided that if someone can be targeted, they can be detained. So when detainees challenge that through the writ of habeas corpus, the court has to decide, does the AOMF cover detention of this individual? And unfortunately, most of the time they found that it does. They have used this idea of associated forces to justify detention and included a broad, expansive idea of the AOMF. A DC circuit judge recognized this problem last year and wrote in an opinion that the troubling question in these detainee cases is whether the law of the circuit has stretched the meaning of the AOMF so far beyond the terms of these statutory authorizations that habeas corpus proceedings are functionally useless. It's amazing the breadth of the AOMF. So let's talk, why does it matter? What effect has it had to be this broad? Under the AOMF, the United States has engaged in military action in Afghanistan, Iraq, the Philippines, Ethiopia, Kenya, Yemen, Somalia, and many others. As we already discussed, the detention in Guantanamo Bay is justified under the AOMF. Senator Durbin said at one point, "None of us who voted for the 2001 AOMF could have envisioned that we were about to give future presidents the authority to fight terrorism as far-flung as Yemen and Somalia." Although I would argue that one person did foresee that. And that's why she voted against it. A former State Department official aptly described the AOMF like a Christmas tree. We just keep hanging more and more and more on it. I like that visual. So how does this relate to what we're all here to discuss, drone strikes? I think you can kind of see where this is going. The AOMF is largely the legal foundation for the targeted killing program for drone strikes. Again, as we said, it's novel in that it authorizes the president to use lethal force, not against a nation state or specified army, but non-state actors, organizations, and individuals. It essentially turns the globe into a battlefield. We cannot talk about drones without talking about the AUMF. Reportedly, administration officials, when they decide who it is that's going to be targeted by drone strike, their first question they ask is this person AUMFable? And usually, it seems the answer is yes. Wendy will help us explore this further in her presentation, but I do want to note that the president does, of course, also have inherent constitutional powers as commander-in-chief, and these include the right, the ability to repel immediate threats to the United States. This is a key part of the drones debate as well. But the AUMF allows the president to rely on specific authorization from Congress to justify his actions, and it enhances the scope of those inherent commander-in-chief powers. So while there's a complicated relationship here, the AUMF, it's the foundation of everything. It changes the entire calculus. So what's next? What will become of the AUMF? Will it go on in perpetuity? It's clear at this point that for the AUMF and the resulting drones program to change in any way, there must be active affirmative change in the law. It will not fade out on its own because it is by design an endless war. Let me say that again. It is by design an endless war. President Obama has indicated a desire to change or to end the 2001 AUMF. In a speech at the National Defense University in May of 2013, he talked about fighting terrorism without keeping America on a perpetual war footing. He said, unless we discipline our thinking, our definitions, our actions, we may be drawn into more wars we don't need to fight or continue to grant presidents unbound powers more suited for traditional armed conflicts between nation states. He then expressed a desire to refine and ultimately repeal the AUMF's mandate. More recently, he's called Congress to right-size or to update the AUMF. However, so far the administration has not taken affirmative actions to move that conversation forward and to work towards actually amending or repealing the AUMF. So what has Congress done? I'll preface this by saying this is prior to the crisis that's happening right now in Iraq and Syria. We'll get to that in a second. But before that, members of Congress have attempted to force votes to sunset or repeal the AUMF. Barbara Lee, of course, introduces a bill every year to repeal it. For the past 2 years, Congressman Adam Schiff of California has introduced amendments to large military authorization bills that would sunset the AUMF. These amendments did fail, but the vote count is really astonishing. Between the two votes together, 210 members of Congress voted in, of the House of Representatives voted in favor of repealing the AUMF. That's enormous. It was a bipartisan vote. Now, elections have happened and swept a few of those affirmative votes out, but and they didn't vote at the same time, weirdly enough. But 210 total members of Congress voted to repeal the AUMF. It's enormous. The calculus is much different now, though. The midterm elections did sweep out a few of those members who voted for AUMF sunset, and the atrocities happening in Iraq and Syria with regard to the extremist group known as ISIS, ISIL, the Islamic State, Daesh, I don't know what else. Regardless of the name, this surge in violence prompted a new U.S. military campaign in the region, and this is really important. The president did not come to Congress before beginning this bombing campaign. He said he already had legal authority, and you can probably guess what it is. That's right, he cited the 2001 AUMF as justification for yet another military campaign. I think this is evidence that the AUMF will continue to be stretched and used for new things as long as it remains with us. So now, as you may have heard in the President's State of the Union address the other night, there is potential for a new AUMF. Many members of Congress, and now the President, are saying that there should be a new, more specific AUMF authorizing force against ISIS. This presents an important new opportunity to re-examine the 2001 AUMF. Let me tell you why. There could be a brand new AUMF, and it could serve as a new venue to address the old 2001 blank check AUMF. It could include a provision that repeals the 2001 AUMF or sunset in some way. It could include provisions that provide geographic boundaries, time limits, or more defined targets. This discussion is happening. It's happening right now. I'll leave you with an update on where this legislation is. At the very end of 2014, right before Congress went into their December recess, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee passed a new ISIS-specific AOMF. I encourage you again to go online, watch the video of the debate, because it is fascinating that after all this time, we are still having the same conversation. They went round and round in circles about how do we limit the president's authority, or if we should limit the president's authority. There were suggestions to provide geographic limitations, or explicitly state that this new authorization would not target associated forces. Those amendments were not adopted. However, a provision was included that would sunset this new AOMF and the old 2001 AOMF after 3 years. So I say all this to tell you two things. One, this is very much a live debate. Right now, as we're sitting in this conference, White House and congressional leaders are debating and are thinking through the future of war authority. They are going to have to make some hard decisions, probably in the upcoming year. We have an amazing opportunity to be a part of that process and to influence that debate. The second thing is that after all this time, it's amazing to me that we are still fighting the same fights and having the same conversations. When SFRC, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, couldn't agree to place boundaries on a new war, to ban the interpretation of associated forces, they're running the risk of making the exact same mistakes all over again with a new AOMF. There are moral questions at the heart of these issues. This community is uniquely positioned to provide a framework that bare law and policy by itself cannot address. I'm so honored to be a part of this conference and look forward to working together on the future of the AOMF. Thank you so much for having me.